It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And at the Academy Awards, the film The Last Repair Shop won Best Documentary Short. And one of its producers is from Wisconsin. The film features the technicians who run the Los Angeles School District's musical instrument repair shop. And that keeps students from all walks of life playing on. Josh Rosenberg is a producer on this film. And Josh grew up in Green Bay and is a graduate of UW-Milwaukee. He talked with Kate Archer Kent about this Oscar win.
How did it feel as your team accepts this Oscar? What was going through your head?
I mean, it was just incredible. I mean, one of the things that we focus on with the films that we make at Breakwater Studios, where I work, is like highlighting people who haven't gotten their due. And so in this film, you know, dealing with we have four repair people who, like, they've done all of this work kind of in the shadows. It's like the instrument breaks and it comes right back to them. They don't even know all the work that goes into it. And so to be there at the Oscars with the repair people, and then also we had two of the LAUSD students with us, and just like seeing it reflected in their eyes in this environment where they're often not in the spotlight, and to see them on the red carpet. And if you watch the telecast, you got to see Porsche, who is one of the students, walk up on stage, which is kind of one of the great moments of the telecast. And just seeing it through their eyes was just so, so amazing.
Porsche Brinker, she melts our heart. I mean,
she's incredible.
She takes it away. And it makes me also wonder just how you and the team decided to like frame these stories and get these kids to really talk about hard things in their lives, and how music has kind of been that has that ability to just keep them carrying on and feel grounded.
Yeah, like what we try to do is really create an intimate environment where people feel like they have that space to be able to have these difficult conversations. And also to some degree, it ended up just being a little bit of luck. You know, you hate to kind of say that, but like, you know, we got a bunch of kids together and we ended up speaking to about 10, and four of them ended up being kind of the main four that you saw in the film. And the craziest thing was Porsche was the first person that we talked to. Hmm. And it was like, it was just one of those things, like she just lit up when she's on camera. You know, some people just have that that intangible that you can't really put your finger on. And a lot of it is just like taking the time, you know, like not trying to like rush through this in 5 or 10 minutes, but like really giving space to have these conversations. And then it was just, you know, them being willing to be open and honest with us about the impact that music has on their lives and talking about some hard things. And, you know, that's really one of the things in documentary that we always talk about. You know, the most important audience member for us are our storytellers. And we specifically use that language. We don't call them subjects. We think that's such an awful word that we use and that's used in documentary filmmaking. So we refer to everyone as storytellers. And, you know, the stories that we have to share with the world is really one of our most precious assets that we can share. And so at Breakwater, we really take that seriously. And I think you can see that in the work that we do. And so it's just creating that environment that they felt comfortable in.
And every one of the four technicians that you profile, they have these really remarkable stories of existence and how they got to where they are. I mean, the tears really start flowing for me when Patty Moreno from Mexico, you know, seeking a better life, that single mom who can't afford even the $20 for the clarinet for her son. I mean, can you describe that moment? She learns she's passed the skills test and been offered a job as a repair technician in the school district.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely one of those moments. You know, we've all seen the film many, many, many times, and it's always incredible where there's moments, whether, you know, you watch it the first time or you're watching it the 15th time, that still gets you. And I think part of it for me being a parent, that I think that sticks in the throat for any parent. And so like that's just a moment in the film that is always so powerful for me. And again, you know, like, giving the space where like you know, you think, oh, this is a short film. Maybe they interviewed him for an hour. You know, we interview people for several hours, 5, 6 hours. And it just, it creates a very different experience for the storyteller, because it's not this, like, you're just trying to like hammer out answers. You're actually able to like have a deep conversation. I mean, you've probably seen it with people when you're doing interviews, where it's like, you know, the content of a conversation drastically changes from the 5 minute mark to the half hour mark to the 4 hour mark to the 8 hour mark, right?
Yes.
Like as it goes, as you can imagine. And so like, so part of it is like, just like having that space and giving time for the interview. That's one of the things that you just like, you just can't recreate that. You can't get people there emotionally when you try to like, you know, do a quick interview. And so, you know, she was just so brave and willing to share that. And then we also see how powerful work is and how powerful a job that gives us meaning is to our lives. And like, and how impactful that was for Patty's trajectory for the rest of her life, which, you know, now she's been at the repair shop for over 20 years now. But, you know, just incredible.
Talking with Wisconsin native Josh Rosenberg, a producer on the Oscar-winning documentary short film, The Last Repair Shop. Josh, the Los Angeles Public School District, it says 80% of its students come from families living in poverty. What did you learn about the significance of free instruments and free instrument repairs as a service for students and their families?
I mean, it's everything. It's, you know, it's giving kids the opportunity to dream. It's giving them the space to, you know, look over the corner of their circumstance. And so, you know, that's one of the things that that we've really felt from the repair folks, and like that we've gotten reflected back to us in the community, because we got to do a number of screenings at a number of LAUSD schools. And just, you know, giving people the opportunity to raise beyond their circumstance. And I think, you know, Chris said it so eloquently, and Chris Bowers, our co-director on the film, says so eloquently in his speech, is that it's not about creating world-class musicians, right? Like, those people are probably going to become world-class musicians regardless of, you know, if they have freely repaired instruments. It's about creating amazing people. And so, you know, that's the thing that I think is so impactful, that like, that's really, when you really hammer down to it, the percentage of people who are going to go on to be, you know, concert pianists and, you know, famous recording artists, you know, it's like the 1% of the 1%, but like the true impact is what you're actually giving to the community.
And inside the repair shop, and just to try to give a visual, I mean, the cinematography too is just incredible, but, I, you know, not seeing a repair shop before for musical instruments, every shot, I was like, wait, what? They submerge that instrument in what? You know, I mean, can you explain this downtown LA warehouse where these technicians are working?
Yeah, it really feels like, well, it's like, it's this giant, it's nondescript building, like looking at it from the outside, like you'd never know the magic that goes on inside the space. And it's like, you go back and it's like, and you know, I think you can pick up some of the cinematography, who David Feeney Mosier, who was our DP, you know, obviously did an amazing job, where it's like, it feels like you're stepping back in time. You know, obviously they have newer technology, but it's like, a lot of this stuff, you think about, you know, these instruments, they're the same instruments that they were in the 80s or in the 60s. And so a lot of the tools and material to fix them are actually old techniques. And so it's like, you really feel like you've like stepped back in time into this like workshop of like the curiosity store or something, you know. It's like, it's just so incredible. And like, you know, seeing their workbenches and like how they've kind of customized their spaces, and like, cause a lot of them have been in these workbenches for 5, 10, 20 years. And it's just like, it's such a magical place that, you know, I'm glad that we were able to open back the veil for the audience.
And it seems as if people have really reacted to these stories and this film. There's a fundraising campaign that's underway. Can you tell us about that effort?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that we try to do at Breakwater is see the actual, the societal impact that our films can have. You know, it's not just about making the films and, hey, thanks for participating and, you know, running off. You know, we really want to see how can we actually use all this publicity and all this excitement to enact real change. And so we've launched a $15 million capital campaign that, you know, is a big goal and is something that, you know, is not going to be accomplished overnight. But, you know, before we did this film, you know, a lot of the people in LAUSD and, you know, in the leadership didn't even know the repair shop existed. And so now we're able to create all this visibility, and now we want to create the resources behind it so that closing the repair shop, which is a decision that a lot of cities around our country have made, and it's, you know, it's a line item in a budget, and oh, we can't spend that, like let's cut that. We want to make it so ingrained in Los Angeles that the idea to eliminate the repair shop here at LAUSD is not ever on the table again. And so, you know, that's our focus. So we have a website, thelastrepairshop.com, where if anybody was motivated and excited by the film, you know, we'll take whatever you can contribute. Would be so excited. And, you know, our goal again is for this to be so successful that other communities, you know, around the country say like, hey, we need that. We need that in Milwaukee, or we need that in Green Bay, or, you know, like that's our dream. And we feel like if we can get more repair shops opened up and can bring this experience and situation to more students around the country, it'd be such a joy.
That is film producer and Wisconsin native Josh Rosenberg talking with Kate Archer Kent about the inspiring film, The Last Repair Shop, that won an Oscar this month for Best Documentary Short. We continue this conversation going behind the scenes on how this film came together to spotlight a musical instrument repair operation and an Academy Award. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this song is called The Alumni. It's performed by current and former students of the Los Angeles School District and the technicians who repair their instruments. The short documentary film, The Last Repair Shop, took home an Oscar this month. It's a look into the lives of devoted repair technicians who work behind the scenes to maintain tens of thousands of instruments for students free of charge. Josh Rosenberg's a producer on the film and a Green Bay native. He talked with Kate Archer Kent about what it takes to create a short doc.
So, Josh, as a producer, what are your day-to-day responsibilities with a film like The Last Repair Shop? Let's walk in your footsteps.
Yeah. You know, a lot of the work is the logistics of how a film gets made. So, you know, we're tracking all the budgets. We're preparing for all the shoots. We actually have a big production in Philly that we're working on. It's like you just have this long list of like it's all the things you can think about, like what's the location that we need? What are the props that we're going to need? Who needs to be there? When do they need to be there? You know, it's creating all of the logistical components that align with the vision that the director has. And one of the most memorable shoots from The Last Repair Shop is the end credit sequence. So, you know, you watch this beautiful film and you're thinking, oh my gosh, you know, we've gone on this journey with these people, you know, and you're thinking you're waiting for the credits to just roll. We've all seen, you know, the black screen with the credits going. But we weren't that as a musical film, that wasn't going to be enough for us. So we ended up getting a 60-person orchestra that was majority comprised of LAUSD alumni and active students that were going to play in this orchestra to play the end credit song. And we did it at Warner Brothers on the big Eastwood stage where, you know, many a Hollywood score has been recorded. And so we had about 100 people that day on set between, you know, the stagehand crew from Warner Brothers, all the musicians, all the production team. So like basically the job on the producer side is like everything that you need in that room and everything all the people that are in that room are going to need to do their jobs, you got to get in that space. And so, you know, I have a wonderful production team that I work with at Breakwater. It was a complete all hands on deck. We needed every available body. But we were able to capture, you know, such an incredible fitting ending to a really beautiful film.
It was so beautiful, that ending. And it also, I mean, it was so cool to see, you know, all the names and the years and the schools of the kids who are participating in that moment. It just, to watch it all come together and be invested as a viewer, because you've seen all of the different bits and pieces of their lives and then coming together at the end. It was also just so rewarding to see that moment and to feel it with these musicians.
Totally. Yeah. And it's such a, you know, for us, it really was this like love letter to LAUSD and the music that's come out of that, to like see all these different, you know, professional musicians with the student musicians, and like, you know, to see all of that come together. And so for me, you know, as it's kind of funny, as the producer of a music documentary, I'm not musically gifted in any way, shape, or form. So as to be in that room and to see all of these musicians, as, you know, the conductor gets them ready, and then to hear the sound live, I mean, it's like all these people playing in unison. I mean, it was such a beautiful experience to actually be in the room and hear that in person.
Talking with Wisconsin native Josh Rosenberg, who is a producer on the Oscar-winning documentary The Last Repair Shop. Josh, I want to turn a little bit to financials here. The film being produced through the LA Times studios, and in January, the LA Times newspaper laid off over 20% of its newsroom, about 115 workers. How is the studio able to produce remarkable films, you know, when the company has financial challenges?
Well, one of the ways that Breakwater works is we actually take on the cost of producing the films. So we've done a number of films with the New York Times. I think we've done like over 14 films with the New York Times. And same with The Last Repair Shop, where what we do is we finance the film. So Breakwater Studios finances the films. And then we find partners that are going to come along that are going to be on the distribution side. So, you know, we were in a position where we were able to handle that, and then worked with the LA Times studio and Fox Searchlight, which was our other distribution partner, on the distribution side of the film. But part of the way that we work here at Breakwater is we invest in our original films as a marketing expense to be able, like, you know, the reason why you and I are having this conversation is because we invested in making this film and, you know, putting it out into the world so that people see the work that we're doing and then connect it to Breakwater Studios. So that's kind of how our business model is. But we're the ones who actually are paying for the film, and then are the owners of the film that then we license to certain distributors.
I see. Okay, so we're going to turn to your Wisconsin roots here before we have to let you go. 2006, you get a degree in broadcast journalism from UW-Milwaukee. As you look back at those years ago, what do you wish you would have learned during college about film production?
Man, I had such a wonderful college experience. You know, I think a lot of times in Wisconsin, like, Madison gets all the attention, which, you know, it rightfully should. I'm a huge Badger fan. But like, we had so many resources in Milwaukee, and I think partly being in, you know, a big radio and television market. And so we had such a wonderful group of amazing people. Mark Suromsky, who is a professor of mine, who just is like, was such a big supporter of mine and really challenged me. You know, we had a television station that we got access to, that we were able to go in and we did this show called Panther Vision. So I just had so many great experiences in college. You know, I mean, I think the thing that like I always point to is like, it's always great for young filmmakers to get on sets as early as possible. So I think like, you know, that would be my one thing is like when you're young and like you can, you know, work for free or, you know, you have that flexibility, like to just get on as many sets as possible. But I went to school for broadcast journalism in at UWM and just had, you know, such great experiences across the board. I got to do an internship at WUWM. You know, so I was, you know, so delighted with the experiences that I got while going to school in Milwaukee.
That's Josh Rosenberg, producer on the Oscar-winning documentary The Last Repair Shop. He's a Wisconsin native and spoke with Kate Archer Kent. The film is now available to watch on YouTube. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and coming up, we're going to be visiting the birds at the Winged Freedom Raptor Hospital in Spooner in Washburn County. But first, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy to tell us about a rivalry between the popular advice columnists Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren.
Legendary advice columnist Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren dished out wise and witty advice to millions of readers for more than half a century. The two were also twins and sometimes bitter rivals. But before they were famous, they lived in Eau Claire, Wisconsin for more than a decade. Dean Robbins brings you the story of the sisters who perhaps could have used some advice themselves.
Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren were America's leading advice columnists from the 1950s into the 21st century. Dear Abby was the world's most widely syndicated newspaper column with 110 million readers. Ask Ann Landers wasn't far behind with 90 million. Each writer solved other people's problems, answering letters with homespun wisdom. However, their own problems with each other proved harder to solve. Ann and Abby became bitter professional rivals, but once upon a time, they were inseparable twin sisters, raising families a mile away from each other in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Born Pauline and Eppy Friedman in Sioux City, Iowa in 1918, they grew up doing everything together. They even had a double wedding in identical dresses and veils. In the 1940s, the twins moved to Eau Claire, where both of their husbands had jobs at the National Presto Appliance Company. Pauline and Eppy cut glamorous figures in their new community. They hosted elaborate parties, volunteered for local charities, and led parades in a Cadillac convertible. They also loved to watch the Eau Claire Bears baseball team at Carson Park, turning heads with their lacquered hairstyles. But by the end of their decade in Eau Claire, cracks appeared in the sisters' relationship. Pauline and her millionaire husband lived in a stately two-story, while Eppy and her poorer husband had a small two-bedroom that Pauline dubbed Peanut Place. They even began trading insults about each other's daughters. The stage was set for a blow-up, and it happened shortly after the twins left Eau Claire in 1954. First, Eppy took over the Ann Landers advice column at the Chicago Sun-Times. A mere 3 months later, Pauline jumped into the advice biz herself, starting Dear Abby under the pen name Abigail Van Buren at the San Francisco Chronicle. Eppy saw it as a hostile gesture, and the sisters stopped speaking. In 1958, a Life magazine article gave them a national platform for their quarrel. She wanted to be the first violin in the school orchestra, Pauline sneered, but I was. Eppy retorted, she's just like a kid who beats a dog until somebody looks and then starts petting it. Ouch. The magazine declared it the most feverish female feud since Elizabeth sent Mary, Queen of Scots, to the chopping block. The dueling advice columnists reconciled in 1964, but hard feelings remained. In a 1979 TV appearance, Eppy claimed she never read Dear Abby. In a magazine interview 2 years later, Pauline mocked Eppy as envious and inferior. For good measure, she said her twin looked old.
Ouch again.
Epi died in 2002 and Pauline in 2013, concluding the saga of Ann Landers versus Abigail Van Buren. You have to wonder if, at the end of their lives, they pined for the innocent pleasures of Eau Claire. Yes, both had become wildly successful since their time in Wisconsin, hailed as America's most influential women. But would they have traded all that to be back in Carson Park, arm in arm, blissfully cheering the Bears baseball team?
Dean Robbins is a journalist and author based in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. Now, where do hawks, owls, and eagles go when they get hurt? What's it like to nurse these raptors back to health and release them back into the wild? And what role do you and I play in helping to care for these animals? For the answers to these questions and your own, we take you to Wisconsin's Winged Freedom Raptor Hospital. And we welcome your questions and comments throughout our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Kim Ammon's a veterinarian and licensed wildlife rehabilitator in Wisconsin. Ammon is the founder of the Winged Freedom Raptor Hospital based in Spooner. Kim, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me on this morning.
Yeah, and the Winged Freedom Raptor Hospital rescues, rehabilitates, and releases these wild birds. What made you decide to open a hospital to treat these animals?
The hospital is really the culmination of my veterinary career. I always treated birds. I was always interested in birds even before I went to veterinary school. And it was a big part of my practice during the years I was actively practicing. When I was facing retirement, I knew I wanted to continue on with the wild bird treatment. And in order to do that, I needed to have a hospital at my disposal. And so we established with a small board of directors and core group of volunteers, we established Winged Freedom as a nonprofit. There is no state or federal funding for wildlife rehabilitation. And so we needed to fundraise. And we started that in about 2021, fundraised very hard and are very proud of the facility that we built and moved into last May. So we have, I have the greatest job in the world. I get to work with these birds every day in a beautiful, brand new facility. Not only is the hospital amazing, but we also have an attached eagle flyway where the bald eagles that are recovering and ready for exercise can condition and strengthen before they are ready to be released. And then enclosures for the hawks and owls as well. So it's a dream come true for me, and I have a great core group of people that help me.
Kim, how many patients are currently in residence at your hospital?
Right now we have five, but that's, because this is our slower season. When the birds migrate south, we tend to slow down. As migration is already in process and starts up in the spring, that number starts to go up dramatically. And in the summer months, it's not uncommon to have, 20 birds here all at the same time.
What kind of capacity do you have at the Winged Freedom Raptor Hospital? Does it get crowded?
Not yet. Okay. We've only been in the facility since May, so I can't say that we have outgrown it or anything yet. Our numbers increase at least 25% every year. So last year we took in 143 birds. And over 50 of those were bald eagles. So that's our number one species that comes in for care here.
Kim Ammon, what are the most common injuries or illnesses that you find wild birds that you're typically treating?
I can tell you that in raptors, almost all of the birds that come in have some kind of human-caused problem. They're either struck at high speed by a vehicle, They may come in with lead poisoning, which always comes from human sources. Mouse rodenticides are a problem. And these things are all preventable and they're all human caused. But those are probably on the top of the list. There is some infighting. It's a very competitive world out there for raptors. And so we do get some fight wounds and things like that. But the vast majority of it is human caused.
And when you talk about lead poisoning, how would we recognize the symptoms of lead poisoning among wild bird populations?
It probably isn't a set of symptoms that the average person is going to recognize. Mostly what a person is going to see is a bird that's weak, maybe can't fly. They assume it has a broken wing or something like that. Birds with lead poisoning have ingested the lead. It has risen in their bloodstream enough to be toxic. And by doing that, it then paralyzes the nervous system and all of their functions. So their muscles, their digestive system, those things shut down and they become very, very sick, nauseated and weak.
The American Eagle Foundation says that a standard 150 grain lead bullet can poison as many as 10 eagles. What can we do to reduce lead poisoning among our raptor population, Kim?
The obvious choice would be to get lead out of the environment. And the most common sources for lead are going to be hunting ammunition and fishing equipment. I know there are movements working actively on that, and I support that wholeheartedly. There is still lead in our wetlands. It's not legal to use that to hunt waterfowl anymore, but all that lead shot is down in the mud and the ducks and frost and things like that bring it back up to where it can be ingested again and start the cycle over. So it's really about us humans opening our eyes and saying, yes, this is a problem I care enough about to do something and get it out of there.
Kim Ammon, our guest, she is the founder of the Winged Freedom Raptor Hospital in northwestern Wisconsin. We invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question or one of your own experiences with rescuing a wild bird, 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. And Kim, who's usually finding and bringing these wild birds to your hospital?
So the way it usually works is a phone call comes into myself or our volunteer rescue coordinator. And that call may come from the general public who found us on the DNR website or Googling us or something. They've either found a bird or they hit a bird or they saw a bird get hit on the highway or an officer finds it or whatever. The call comes in. We try to make contact with the caller if they're not the one that called us. And ask them to stay with the bird if they can, keep eyes on it. And then we scramble one of our volunteers to try and go out and see what this bird needs. And so it may be the volunteer coordinator himself. Most of the bald eagles are picked up by him. Some of the smaller birds, we've tried to establish a network of people. We cover such a large area. Because there are no other raptor rehabilitators in any of the counties around us, we cover 10 counties or more. And it's a long way for these people to put miles on their cars. So we do try to establish volunteers in other communities that are outlying that we've trained, and they will go out and do whatever needs to be done to rescue the bird, get it boxed up and transported back to the hospital. And that frees up my time so that I'm not out on the road trying to do the rescuing. I can focus on the needs of the medical and surgical needs of the birds in the hospital.
How long does it generally take to rehabilitate a wild bird once they come to your hospital?
It really depends what they came in for. Broken bones need 4 to 6 weeks just to mend, and then there's a reconditioning a couple of months after that as the bird gets to using the limb again and re-establishing muscle and strength and conditioning. If they have lead poisoning and it's at a treatable level, a couple of months while we get the lead out, and then again they recondition and fly and strengthen back up. So it really depends what they come in with. In the spring and summer, we do get quite a few calls for baby raptors. Mm-hmm. We always try to establish that those raptors actually need rescuing. Their best chance for being a normal wild bird is to be raised by their parents. And so if there's any chance that we can either patch up the bird and return it to the nest or to the parents. That's what we do. In some cases, it just isn't possible. And so we raise those birds for as long as we need to until they know how to take care of themselves.
Kim Ammon is the founder of Winged Freedom Raptor Hospital based in Spooner. And we invite you to a conversation about what to do when you find an injured wild bird. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a story to share or a question about wildlife rehabilitators in Wisconsin. Do you know where your closest wildlife rehabilitator resides? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're talking with a licensed wildlife rehabilitator about their work at the Winged Freedom Raptor Hospital in Washburn County. And we welcome your questions and stories about injured animals and the work it takes to help them heal and release them back into the wild. 800-642-1234 to join us, 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, Kim Ammon, is a veterinarian and licensed wildlife rehabilitator in Spooner. And Kim, I'm seeing the stories this morning. We're hearing the stories this morning of bird flu that has spread to dairy cows in Texas. And in January, the State Agriculture Department reported a case of avian influenza in Washburn County, where you are. Although the case involved commercial birds, your hospital is located there. Does this case of bird flu and others concern you?
So avian influenza was a huge problem 2 summers ago when it came across the oceans in migration and spread across the U.S. And of course had huge economic impact on chicken producers and other poultry producers. For us in our business that summer, we saw a lot of cases. I euthanized many, many animals, many birds in the field that were displaying outward symptoms of it, because once they're severely afflicted like that, there's no treatment, there's no cure, and euthanasia is the kindest thing we can do for them. They really are suffering. Since then, it has come and gone. It's around. We know it's there, just like any other widespread virus or something. You know, it hangs around, but it tends to prey on the weak and on birds that congregate. So poultry operations are a prime example of where we've got lots and lots of birds in a concentrated situation, and one case of it getting in there spreads like crazy. And of course, it's a big deal. For us, we've had at least 2 cases this calendar year that I am quite sure had flu. One was a bald eagle and one was a great horned owl. These birds were displaying symptoms outwardly of the flu, and they're things that you can be trained to see. There are tests available and so on, but these birds were so severely afflicted that we euthanized and made sure that it didn't get into our facility. So it's something that we are screening for, visually watching for symptoms. It can look like other things like lead poisoning or other problems, but we are actively aware that it's around. It isn't magically going to spread to our facility. It would have to be brought in by another bird. And so the enclosures that we have for our birds are specifically designed to keep other birds out. We don't share space or water sources or anything like that with waterfowl or anything that could bring it in. And so we take every precaution that we can, to keep it out.
Let's go to your calls and questions now at 1-800-642-1234. David, good morning.
On April 15th, Dubai had ourselves something nice. And
I'm sorry. We'll go to Ann and Waldo next. Ann, good morning.
Good morning. I'm happy to be on. I have a good friend, Jeannie Lord. She runs the Pine View Wildlife Refuge in Wabaca.
Yeah?
And she's been doing it since 1980. saving raptures, baby foxes, all sorts of birds, reptiles. It's a wonderful organization.
What's the organization called, Ann?
Pine View Wildlife Refuge.
Hey, thank you.
And it's in Wapakot.
Hey, thank you for that. And Kim, where do you go to find, do we have enough wildlife rehabilitators in Wisconsin, and where do you go to find them?
So I would tell you that any wildlife rehabilitator would say there aren't enough of us because we get so busy and overwhelmed. You can find a rehabilitator in your area by getting on the DNR website and checking county by county. There's a map on there and you can click county by county. It'll tell you who's licensed and what species they take. You can also call the DNR hotline and they will refer you to someone in your area that can help you. I do get calls for species I don't take, and people are upset when I can't help them with their raccoon or their woodpecker or whatever, but everyone is licensed for species that they are set up to treat, and we follow DNR and Fish and Wildlife regulations in the work that we do. So the best way to do it is online.
Kim Ammon, as we wrap up here, when I find a wild bird that might be injured or sick, what actions can I take to do the best for this animal?
If you can wait to touch that bird and get in touch with a rehabilitator, that's the best way. So call law enforcement, call, get on the DNR website, whatever. Find somebody that you can talk to help you determine if that animal really needs help. If it does, then follow their instructions as to what to do. I do not have members of the public handle dangerous animals like bald eagles. They really can hurt you. But if it's a small bird or a small hawk, something like that, I may have the caller, you know, gently wrap it in a towel, put it in a box and get it secured. And then we work on trying to get it transported to the hospital. So get in touch with somebody that can get you advice. If you're alone, if you're remote, you don't have a signal, you can't find somebody or whatever, and you really feel that the bird needs help, then go through those steps to, you know, gently restrain the bird if it's small enough to do so and get it to help as fast as you can.
And finally, this morning, with about a minute left, what can we do to prevent the injuries in the first place, Kim?
One of the biggest things in our area, being such a wide open rural area, is we have so much roadkill, you know, deer and things like that. You know, stop, slow down when you see a deer on the side of the road. There's probably something that's been feeding on it or maybe currently feeding. We get in eagles on a regular basis that are down feeding on these animals and take off. They don't realize what's going to happen when they fly in front of a car. They get hit. So take the deer off the side of the road if you can. Get it off into the field. That can go a long way in helping, but slow down and pay attention.
Hey, Kim, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me on. This was great.
Kim Ammon, founder of Winged Freedom Raptor Hospital based in Spooner and Washburn County. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent. And do you think Joe Biden's too old to be president? Do you believe Donald Trump's unwell and unable to serve as commander-in-chief? What about Hillary Clinton 8 years ago? Or John McCain 16 years ago? Or Bob Dole before that? Shall I go on? Accusations of illness have become such a pervasive part of political campaigns that we may not even notice the role they play or the ramifications they have. So I'll ask you. Have you noticed? Your questions and comments are welcome here throughout this hour. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org as well anytime. Our guest is Lisa Dietrich, an author and professor of women's, gender, and sexuality studies at Stony Brook University in New York. Lisa's new book, Illness, Politics, and Hashtag Activism, will be published by the University of Minnesota Press in May. And Lisa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, so you've spent decades exploring how topics like health activism, disability, and illness intersect with our politics. And let's just start with a big grand question here. Why is illness so central to American politics.
Yeah. Illness is one of these things that we, of course, all experience. And so it's a universal experience. And one of the things that we're seeing in relation to politics is the way, and this is why I use the term illness politics, because I want to talk about how it's actually influencing and affecting our politics. So we all experience illness, but it's also being used politically. And so we've seen this, especially in the last couple of elections. And I try to look at how illness is used politically through on social media, specifically by looking at hashtags and as a sort of portal through which to analyze illness politics.
And Lisa, with all your research in medicine, philosophy, what made you decide to dive into illness in politics?
Yeah, my background, my training is actually in gender studies, but I've always been sort of fascinated by illness and how it figures in American political life. And so I've always looked at one of the first things that I was interested in was this sort of rise in people writing memoirs about their experiences of illness. And so my first book is called Treatments, and it was about how people write about and try to understand and come to understand their own experiences of illness. And I was really interested in how these sort of narratives about illness try to kind of figure out a way to describe the symptoms that people are experiencing. But then there's something bigger going on too, where people are trying to understand illness as a sort of category that intersects with other experiences and other categories like race, gender, class, and sexuality. So that was the beginning. I mean, part of it was just seeing these books and seeing that people were writing, trying to kind of come to terms with their own experiences of illness. But I was also very interested in, and this kind of goes back to the HIV/AIDS epidemic, and I was very interested in how people politicized illness and sort of to bring about social change around how we treat, how the government supports or not particular illnesses, funds research for illnesses, et cetera. So I saw this as a kind of experience that everybody can kind of relate to. We all know what it means to be ill,
right?
I mean, it's universal, truly. Although it's not that everybody experiences it the same, but it is universal. And so I wanted to look at that and see actually how that experience is written about, talked about, and politicized.
And what I found interesting, Lisa, is how solid of a case you make that this is just part of our American politics and the, how far back this goes. But at the same time, you wouldn't necessarily think of it. It didn't come top of mind to me as a voter, as somebody who, you know, follows politics. I didn't stop to think about it until you said it. We use illness as a way to, well, weaponize weakness in American politics.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, this is what I think. And I do think there's a kind of tie to what we're seeing is with social media, we can kind of see that more effectively used. Perhaps it is an old tactic. It's not new at all. And I sort of first became interested in it in relation to JFK's Addison's disease. So the 1960 election, the Nixon was a very close election, and the Nixon campaign really were trying. They knew something was up with JFK in terms of that he had this sort of chronic condition, but they didn't really have evidence. And the Kennedy never sort of talked about this, right? So kept it secret. And so there was an attempt to kind of utilize that against Kennedy, but it really wasn't, they didn't do that. And it was a very close election. Kennedy, of course, won. And then what we discovered later after his assassination, not actually until 1992, did we finally learn from his autopsy that he had Addison's disease and that his adrenal glands just simply weren't functioning. Mm-hmm. So there's an example of somebody who had an illness, a chronic condition, which was stigmatized. This is kind of one of the important things, is that we stigmatize many illnesses. So in that sense, Kennedy did want to keep this quiet, because it would have had an impact on how voters saw him. Although, did it have an impact in terms of how he governed or what type of leader he was? That becomes one of the questions. But there's a long history of this. But now what we see is a kind of attempt to politicize it more, to sort of question people's capacity to lead because of certain illnesses. Or in the case we're seeing right now, age, mm-hmm. right? So this is what I'm kind of interested in, how you know, people get sick and how does that impact them? Does that prevent them from leading? I don't think so. So why is it that this is being used to kind of question people's capacity to lead?
Lisa Dietrich, our guest, she is the author and a professor at Stony Brook University. Her upcoming book, Illness Politics and Hashtag Activism. One thing they didn't have back in 1960 was social media, and I wonder how things would have been different if they did, Lisa. You write about hashtags that were popular during the 2016 presidential election, including hashtag sick Hillary and hashtag Trump is not well. You also reference this YouTube video by a Trump opposition group called the Lincoln Project that summarizes the sentiment behind the Trump is not well hashtag.
Something's wrong with Donald Trump. He's shaky, weak, trouble speaking, trouble walking. The most powerful office in the world needs more than a weak, unfit, shaky president. Trump doesn't have the strength to lead, nor the character to admit it. We're not doctors, but we're not blind. It's time we talk about this. Trump is not well.
And Lisa, you write about how illness is used as a metaphor for being unfit to serve in public office. How do Trump opponents like the Lincoln Project, which have gone forward now with a new YouTube video called Trump is Still Not Well, how do they use this, utilize this as illness as a metaphor?
Yeah, no, I mean, I haven't listened to that clip in a while, and boy, the voice, right?
Uh-huh.
You're really led to believe, you have to kind of think about how that's working on you. The voice, and we're not seeing image because we're on radio, but the images that are tied in with the words, with the what the person is saying about Trump. I look at hashtags from 2016 and also 2020. And first I begin with sick Hillary, hashtag sick Hillary, which was started by right-wing activist Mike Cernovich, and which was sort of meant to show that Hillary had some sort of condition in her brain, something was wrong. And then, you know, of course, this is one of, I call this one of Trump's, illness politics is to me one of Trump's signature tactics. Mm. He's very good at sort of showcasing the weaknesses of his opponents, and he does a good job of kind of imitating even, you know, when Hillary Clinton collapsed at the 9/11 ceremonies in New York, Trump then, you know, right away started sort of imitating her collapse on stage at his rallies. So Trump is very good at illness politics, I would say.
Yeah, and I would like to dig into this a little bit more with our guest, Lisa Dietrich. She is the author of a new book on illness and politics, also a professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at Stony Brook University in New York. Your questions and comments are welcome here throughout the hour, 1-800-642-1234. Have you stopped to think about how illness is used as a metaphor for politicians to be unfit for office? It seems perhaps... I had not, so I'd be interested in what you had to think, what you think about it. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. So what was this purpose of the hashtag Sick Hillary during the presidential race of 2020? It's the morning show. I'm Lee Raven, and we're exploring the nexus of health and politics with our guest, Lisa Dietrich, author and professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at Stony Brook University. Her upcoming book, Illness, Politics, and Hashtag Activism. And your invitation to join us is at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. And Lisa, from your book, Illness, Politics, and Hashtag Activism, you say this hashtag Sick Hillary was used to counter Clinton's serious messages about Donald Trump and white supremacy. Was it effective? Did it work?
Yeah, I think it did work. I think what was kind of happening was an attempt to, counter her message and also her as a candidate, somebody who we would see as a leader. So I think it's one of the things that I say is that illness politics sort of intersects with racial, sexual, and class politics, and also sometimes kind of stands in for those politics. So Sick Hillary became this way that we had to speculate about what was wrong with Clinton. And the premise was that something was wrong and it was in her brain, but we didn't really know what it was. And so the rampant speculation is kind of part of the politics that, it doesn't matter if we're kind of thinking, oh, maybe it's Parkinson's, maybe it's epilepsy, all these different possibilities kind of allow the ideas to circulate more.
The power of the secret illness. And it goes all the way back to, as you mentioned, JFK in 1960.
Yeah. Exactly. The power of the secret illness is the right way to put it, because we're going to what happens with illness. One of the things in my long studying of illness and what happens with illness is that it gets linked to moral. It's illness is not seen just as a biological condition, but we often make moral judgments based on illness. And so we have a tendency, unfortunately, to kind of blame the victim of illness, to suggest that they're somehow responsible for their illness. And although I think we see this a little less now, I still think it's operating. And so it can be used to operate politically. And so there was, Trump was basically trying to say, you can't trust Hillary Clinton. And, there's the Clintons and this kind of denigration of their, of whether we should trust them or not. There's a long history of that. And so he was sort of utilizing that. But what I look at with Trump is not well in 2020 is that, as I say in the book, Trump was kind of hoist on his ableist petard. He was basically, the illness politics that he himself had used were used against him by the Lincoln Project. Yeah. And we're seeing it right now. Trump is not well, is still circulating on social media, that hashtag. And as you said, Trump is still not well, mm-hmm. is now a new hashtag. So we're kind of using Trump's tactics again, or certain people are using Trump's tactics against him.
But what about our role in this as an informed electorate? And I'd go back to the story, and it gets a lot of attention, and you talk about it in Illness, Politics, and Hashtag Activism, of Donald Trump at a rally openly mocking a news reporter with a disability. It got a lot of attention, but as you point out, not as much attention seemed to be paid to the actual policies that the candidate was offering regarding people with disabilities, accessibility, and equity.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. That's one of the main points that I'm trying to make is that, so Trump, we know this image. I think most of your listeners will know the image of Trump mocking disabled reporter Serge Kovalevsky. And what, I talk about some polls that showed at that time, American people did not like that. Okay, so they really genuinely didn't like that he imitated a disabled person. Now, that doesn't quite get at what they might be enjoying in watching him, at his rallies and his supporters, what they might enjoy about that he sort of does that kind of thing that we think is improper, right?
Bad behavior.
Yeah, bad behavior, that we sort of value his bad behavior in some ways. I think there is a way that he's expressing something that people want expressed. And so I think that was sort of operating. But what happens is, so we see that. That's in the Trump Is Not Well video from the Lincoln Project. They show that image of him imitating Serge Kovalevsky. But what disabled activists at that time said and called for was not to kind of focus on that, not to focus on his bad behavior, but to actually focus on his policies, which were not good for disabled people. And so his attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, to cut Medicaid, this is what we need to focus on, rather than his bullying bad behavior. And that's what I kind of also try to focus on in the book, is to shift from this sort of electoral politics that's happening with a slogan like, with a hashtag like Trump Is Not Well, to disability activism that's focused on policy.
And that's the whole second half of your upcoming book. And it's interesting that how this is used by campaigns, this hashtag activism and illness politics used by campaigns to try to get you to vote for your candidate or the other candidate. But at the same time, this hashtag activism and illness politics is being employed by people with disabilities to try to move what has been a marginalized agenda front and center in front of the people. I think the reason we keep doing it, the reason you take this all the way back to 1960, Lisa, is because it works. It's effective.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, so I do want to look at both the attempts to kind of suggest people are sort of don't have a certain capacity to lead. So that's the critique of that use of hashtags to kind of challenge people's fitness for office. But then I also want to turn and look at the importance of illness and disability activism. And so the second half of the book looks at very specific work by and very kind of varied work by disability activists to kind of change the conversation about disability, away from this kind of question about fitness, right, that is sort of undermining and emphasizes sort of weakness, to something that sort of says, why not kind of create a world in which everyone can participate, in which more people can participate. So that's, I'm really interested in that sort of activism that's looking to create, that has a different vision of community and the world and justice, I think.
Yeah, but it's activism that some have criticized as being not actually active, being virtual and not real. But at the same time, for some people with disabilities, it may be the most action they can make. And you make a case in your book that these actions have made a difference in our politics.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Lisa, so I gotta take a break here for news. I apologize, but our conversation is going to continue through the rest of this hour because we've got a lot left to get to, including, as you mentioned, the second half of your book, which is about how activists can employ these same tools to make a difference from their perspective, and how hashtag activism actually has moved the needle in our American politics. We invite you to our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lisa Dietrich, our guest, her upcoming book, Illness Politics and Hashtag Activism. You can also email us ideas at WPR.org. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent. And show me what democracy looks like. How does online political organizing translate into real, fundamental change? Answering the question of what constitutes real activism has been at the forefront of our guests' decades of work. This is what democracy looks like. Lisa Dietrich is an author and professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at Stony Brook University in New York. Lisa's upcoming book is called Illness Politics and Hashtag Activism. And we invite you to our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. And Lisa, let's talk about real activism here, as the second half of your book has to do with hashtag activism and how people with disabilities have made a difference in the disability movement and our politics for all of us. So in examining real activism, what for you in researching this would qualify?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, there's a long kind of history of sort of denigrating what's called hashtag activism. So this idea that folks on social media are using hashtags to promote certain politics, and that that's not actually real politics. That's not getting out there in the street, you know, occupying public space, marching, being arrested, et cetera. So what I kind of want us to look at what we think of when we think of the figure of the activist. And we generally think of a sort of person out in public, right? And making a change through the kind of showing the urgency of their cause. And I think we need to sort of shift that a little bit and kind of understand that there are some people who are less able to sort of be in the public sphere, but that doesn't mean that they can't do activism and be activists. So I'm sort of challenging this idea of what we take to be an activist, and also the kind of habit of denigrating the hashtag activism, because what I discover through looking at various disability oriented hashtags, like adapt and resist and crip the vote, and even long COVID,
yeah,
is also an important one, is that actually that is functioning to shift political life in the U.S. And so what we see is a kind of interesting combination where in the case of adapt and resist, your listeners will probably recall some of these images, but the disability rights and justice group ADAPT protested on Capitol Hill in 2017, basically did a die-in at Senator McConnell's office, and they were arrested. So we have these images, both still images and also video, of them being, for example, removed from their wheelchairs to be arrested. So I include in the book an image of the ADAPT activist Stephanie Woodward being carried out by these kind of burly Capitol guards, police officers. But you know, one of the things that I'm sort of showing is that she is an activist. She knows what she's doing, and she was actually sort of wanting that media publicity to convey the importance of Medicaid for disabled people. So she was kind of putting her body on the line to show the American public what Medicaid meant for disabled people like her. So that's direct action politics. That's disabled people doing direct action politics. And I kind of argue that they're able to sort of use their vulnerability that we can kind of see as a tactic to make people understand what this means to them. But I also look at more exclusively online activism, and I'm trying to say that's important, that online activism around that kind of circulates around hashtags creates community and has a very real impact on our politics.
But as you write in your book, and with a question that I'm left with, is kind of profound. How do you protest when the very act is a dire threat to what little ability you have left? And it stops and make you think.
Yeah, I mean, and what I look at there is activists who have long COVID and also ME, CFS, myelogic encephalomyelitis, or chronic fatigue syndrome. And they, those folks have been protesting in public. They do a regular protest called hashtag Millions Missing that's usually combines a public element. So they protested several months ago in front of the White House, but there's also online components to their activism. And, you know, what they're actually doing is sort of, yes, showing us, again, how important this is, this issue is for them. And they want the sort of government to take seriously and also to better fund research for ME and CFS and long COVID. And also they're trying to sort of counteract the fact that many people sort of don't believe or, you know, they encounter doctors who are disbelieving of these chronic conditions. And so they're sort of trying to counteract that. And one of the ways that they're showing that is by putting their vulnerable bodies in public. Yeah, the question of whether how they succeed or not is important and challenges what we take activism to be, I think. And I think this is one of the more sort of important points of my book, that is to really show that disabled people are capable of engaging in politics. They are, and they do. And it's important that we kind of heed what they're trying to struggle to bring about.
We're talking about the new book, Illness Politics and Hashtag Activism, with our guest author, Lisa Dietrich, professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at Stony Brook University. You're welcome to join our conversation with your questions or experiences, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Lisa, I'd be curious to know from you what you see as the limits to social media activism, or for that matter, when does social media become inadequate to meet the needs of activists?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that the book tries to show is that there's several things going on social media. There is the use of social media to kind of create illness politics that is stigmatizing and sort of suggesting that certain people are not capable of leading. And I think there's the kind of danger of, I talk about a practice I call diagnosing by GIF or GIF, where we take a very short clip, and this is what happens in the Trump Is Not Well video, a short clip in Trump Is Not Well, we see Trump apparently not being able to drink water, and he has to use two hands, right? It's a 3-second clip of him having difficulty drinking water at a speech at the military academy. So, you know, my point is, what is that showing? Why are people saying that that shows something about his incapability? And they also show him kind of having difficulty walking down a ramp. So, and I think this is going to get worse with AI, because, of course, not only are we taking little clips, but we're also now creating clips that supposedly showcase somebody's problems. And we saw this with a video of Nancy Pelosi apparently slurring her words. And then we learned that, well, no, the video was slowed down and mm-hmm. so manipulated. So the problem of manipulation. And I do worry a lot about that, especially in the coming election. I think we're seeing the way that social media does manipulate people. And so one of the points of the book is to try to just get people to think about this and how this is being used politically, to just simply say, okay, what's going on politically here? And how can we sort of assess what's going on politically?
I'm curious about the medium itself, too, specifically the ownership. Have you seen changes with Elon Musk's X compared to the old Twitter? Are there challenges that activists face online when it comes to engaging through Instagram or the Facebook universe?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I there are lots of changes on Musk's X. And, you know, Twitter was never perfect, and none of these social media platforms are perfect at all. But I think what we saw, there were some sort of immediate changes. I mean, Musk immediately fired the accessibility group. So people that were trying to sort of work to make the platform more accessible, he fired that group. I don't think there's a replacement group. And we're also seeing, and so I think lots of disabled people who use, there's a whole disabled Twitter community, people using Twitter to create community. And I think there have been people who have felt they need to leave, and that the way it's sort of operating now, what's sort of being amplified or not, is sort of questionable. So, I mean, I think that's one of the hardest things is that what you saw was, and I try to show this, especially through the group Crip the Vote, who began sort of using the hashtag Crip the Vote in 2016 to kind of generate conversations about disability and how disability was so sort of central to all different topics. And if we sort of take a disability perspective, then we really have an interesting approach to social and political life. And I argue that they had a huge impact. I kind of argue that they possibly, you know, helped in terms of Fetterman's election, Senator Fetterman's mm-hmm. election. I think there was an impact because I think the conversation had shifted. And we saw people joining Crip the Vote Twitter chats, like Senator Warren, Mayor Buttigieg. And we sort of saw that that people were realizing that disability is an important part of this conversation. So I think that had an impact on, and also it made people sort of understand what ableism is and how it works. And so I think that had an impact on Fetterman and his campaign and how they decided to handle his stroke. I think he is a sort of really interesting example of someone who quite effectively counteracted stigma and ableism. I do kind of think that he was able to do that because there's something about who he was that was able to actually show that vulnerability and generate a sort of somewhat positive response to his public display of vulnerability.
Lisa Dietrich, author of a new book on illness politics and the professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at Stony Brook University in New York. She stays with us, but we're running out of time this hour, so we invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn on the Ideas Network, and our guest this hour has been talking about the intersectionality of activism, our politics, and people with disabilities. Lisa Dietrich, the author of the new book, Illness, Politics, and Hashtag Activism, and a professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at Stony Brook University in New York. And you're welcome to join us before our hour is out at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And I want to ask Lisa about the other aspects of your research here and how they play into illness, politics, and hashtag activism. What role does race and gender play when it comes to activism and people with disabilities and the effectiveness in our politics?
Yeah, I think they all intersect. I mean, this is one of the sort of points of this concept of intersectionality, that gender, race, class, and I would add illness and disability intersect in terms of our experience of the world and how politics operate. So that's really what I'm interested in studying. So, you know, one thing that people are aware of is, you know, in the last chapter, I look at long COVID, and one of the things that people have sort of talked about in relation to long COVID and other illnesses that we don't fully understand biologically is that this sort of process of medical gaslighting, where people are not necessarily believed when they try to tell their doctor what they're experiencing in their bodies. They're not necessarily believed, or there's a way that the doctor might respond with the thought that it's psychological or stress related rather than biological. So there's a sort of denial of people's authority in their own experience of their body. And what we see is that that is very much about gender, and it's about race, that the people who are less likely to be believed are women, and especially women of color. So I try to look at that, how that is sort of operating in the problem of that. So in the last chapter, I talk about a short film that made by the Washington Post about Cynthia Adenig, who is a person who has long COVID. And she basically shows us that she, you know, her experiences of her symptoms were not taken seriously. And in fact, not only not taken seriously, but not believed. And so one of the things that would happen to her when she would go to the hospital was that she would be drug tested. And so she's like many people with long COVID, connected to other people with long COVID online. So this becomes a resource for them, and also a place of community building. And she connects with a woman who is a white woman who says, well, you know, and they basically have very similar experiences of symptoms with long COVID, but their experience of medicine is a little bit different. And the woman who she communicates with says, I've never been drug tested. And she says, the only difference between you and me is that I can see is that I'm white and you're black. And so kind of really thinking about how race, class, gender, disability kind of impacts our experience of healthcare is one of the key things that I want to sort of communicate with the concept of illness politics.
Lisa Dietrich, our guest from Stony Brook University, with the upcoming book, Illness Politics and Hashtag Activism. And you want this book to serve as a guidebook for other activists who are looking to find models that are effective in making a difference in their community and helping to solve some of the problems that their community faces. And we are we're facing another presidential election this year. Campaigns already well underway. Lisa, what's your advice for activists involved in this year's elections?
Well, my advice would be to really show how healthcare is sort of a central issue in our election, and how disability is a central issue in our election. A couple of examples, of course. I mean, so, you know, abortion is a healthcare issue, right? So abortion is healthcare is a hashtag people have used. So, you know, how does that sort of connect with other healthcare issues? Also, I would say that, you know, what's happening in Gaza right now is about illness politics as well, and health and disability. What we see there is what we would call a mass disabling event. We're sort of creating conditions for more illness and disability and death as well. So I think it's helpful. A disability perspective helps us really see the kind of I would say that see, you know, vulnerability as a sort of fundamental human condition, but also kind of really consider how we can understand ourselves as interdependent, right? This is a kind of something you learn from disability justice work, that we are interdependent. We're not independent of each other. And so I really want us to kind of think about a vision of where we're sort of regarding, not disregarding, our fellow people and thinking about how we can kind of create a world that helps people rather than is kind of stigmatizing and also disabling.
Hmm. Lisa, we got about a minute left, but if you're not an activist and just an engaged voter heading towards November, you mentioned the vulnerability as a human condition, but there are also the politics of weaponizing weakness among other candidates. How should I as a voter move forward with understanding this year's election? What should I look for?
Well, I know that, you know, age has become a kind of, there's a way that people have worried about age, especially in relation to President Biden and also in relation to former President Trump. I think it's very simplistic to just say that age equals incapacity or that we become increasingly incapacitated with age. So I would just get people to sort of understand the complexity of issues, the complexity of what we're capable of or not. And my main point that I want to communicate is that we have contrasting visions of the world. And the vision that I think is really important to emphasize is our shared humanity, is our interdependence. And so I want to kind of enact that through politics.
And thank you for doing it. And thank you for joining us this morning, Lisa.
Thank you for having me.
Lisa Dietrich's an author and professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at Stony Brook University in New York. Look for her upcoming book, Illness, Politics, and Hashtag Activism, from the University of Minnesota Press in May. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.